Welcome to the Reaction Podcast with me, Ian Martin, editor of Reaction. I'm joined by my colleagues, Maggie Pagano and Alistair Benn. Only one topic, really, that's possible to discuss this week. This is the Reaction Podcast, which sometimes we put it out on video, but we're also just going back to the old school version sometimes of just doing the traditional podcast that we used to do pre-pandemic, where two or three members of the team kick around the stories which have grabbed us and give our perspective. And this week, Maggie, it's really all about Ukraine and Russia. And you've been, like me, in the news business some considerable time, seen a lot of stories come and go. But it's a while, maybe 9/11 actually, is the last time I was quite so shaken by a live news event.
Yeah, absolutely. And yet we've all been warned about this in graphic detail, in fact, for what, 3-4 months? And I think that's perhaps why it's so extraordinary, is that what has been talked about has actually happened. It's not often that that occurs. You know, there was a reason there were 120,000 Russian troops to the north, to the east, and to the south of Ukraine. So I think that makes it doubly shocking. And also, it's really, I mean, the reactions to this are widespread. Some people say that the West is not behaving strong enough, boots on the ground to sanctions. And I think so far, actually, my response would be, certainly from the UK and the US point of view, we've done what we should have done at this stage. Whether we are able to take further action, for example, like blocking Russia from SWIFT, you know, something that would really hurt it. Maybe actually it's wise not to do that straight away. We need some room to maneuver to try and bring him to the table. But other than sending troops on the ground, which obviously we're not going to do, I can't see what else there is that we can do at this stage. I know you probably disagree, don't you? You think we should send more military hardware.
I think you've got to be really careful on the escalation point, because Ukraine is not a NATO member, so there is dealing with someone who's highly unpredictable as Putin is, and is he mad or is he pretending to be mad? Is he behaving rationally or is he just trying to terrify people so that they don't respond forcefully enough? It's very difficult, and there is, as the Armed Forces Minister said in the House of Commons yesterday, I think, there is a real danger of people making mistakes, and through just rhetoric and misjudgments, the thing escalating even further. Now, from the we'll come to the Ukrainian resistance and the Ukrainian fight back in a moment. It's already escalated in the most horrific way in Ukraine. But I think we have to be quite careful and calm about how we think through beyond Ukraine, because to me, that's really what the story is about. It is an independent, free country being terrorized, and its government is in the process of being replaced. We're probably looking at several years of guerrilla warfare, real mid-20th century style or 1940 style partisan warfare and brutality from an occupying force. The whole thought of it is absolutely chilling. But beyond that, there's the question of what do you do to defend Poland, to defend the Baltics, to ensure that Sweden and Finland are not menaced, because having listened to his speech, it was a speech not of the heir of Stalin, but it was a speech of a Russian imperialist who sees this in terms of Russian empire. And I don't think it's really just about Ukraine. But Alistair, you've been slightly worried by some of the responses. And of course, as we've been warning about this for months, and been writing and reading about what's really going on with Russia for ages, so it shouldn't be a shock. But still, I found the actual event itself, it's happening, war in Eastern Europe, somehow chilling.
I think it's time on the side of the West and in the UK for us to have some really, I think, clear thinking. So, for example, I mean, the SWIFT payment system. argument is an interesting one. So, you know, we need to retaliate in some way, and we probably need to retaliate in a way that falls short of military retaliation, given the potential for escalation. Things like no-fly zones are not just abstractions that are imposed from a distance. That would require some serious hardware from the West going up against Russia, which is a nuclear-armed state. So, you know, we need to be a little bit careful about calling for things which would escalate it further. But the SWIFT payment system argument of, you know, SWIFT, the payment system is just a payment system. It is a global network. Blocking Russia from it would, of course, cause harm to the Russian economy. But, you know, I've seen it pointed out that the kind of medium-term outcome of doing that is potentially to link Russia, the Russian and Chinese economy more closely, because there would be a major push from the Chinese side and Russian side to create new software, which puts them outside the international payment system.
Yeah.
And that has been suggested. I find that, you know, I think whether that happens or not, it's an interesting counterfactual, future counterfactual of like, let's just be very calm and think through how we retaliate step by step and what is actually going, I think, to make a difference on the kind of reality in Ukraine. So Ukraine has been preparing for quite a long time for the possibility of a full-scale invasion and a guerrilla campaign that would follow. I mean, there were figure in the Ukrainian government last year talked about Ukraine's readiness to go for a partisan war in the case of a full Russian invasion. This was towards the end of 2021. In the last few years, since 2014, which was a real, in many ways, a massive humiliation of the Ukrainian state in both in Crimea and in the eastern regions, they have built up a lot of sort of structures. There are these sort of territorial forces, which are reservists, who are local networks of kind of guerrilla-style fighters that are supposedly throughout the west of throughout Ukraine. So they've tried to build up that capability, presumably because they kind of understood what might happen in the future. And, you know, whether that will be a success or not, guerrilla warfare has many costs. We have to accept those if we choose to arm insurgents. It is very, very destructive to populations. It clearly is what is going to unfold in the next chapter. Will it work? You know, guerrilla campaigns often need a redoubt, if you like, a kind of geographical redoubt. In Ukraine, there is a history in the Carpathian Mountains of insurgents of guerrilla campaigning against both alternately the Soviets and the Nazis in the 40s. I forget exactly the name of that group. And I was reading this morning, I was trying to work it out. Carpathian Mountains, probably more accessible nowadays, but they still don't have any asphalt roads in most of these parts of the Carpathian Mountains. So that signals perhaps that it's not networked. It's also a very poor part of Ukraine.
I think it triggers several questions about the nature of modern partisan warfare and what that's going to look like and the implications and the potential for escalation and how the West handles it. The first thing is, I know Alistair, you've been for Engelsberg Ideas and for Reaction been thinking about commissioning some academic experts on the history of partisan warfare, because that the reality is that it's ancient and universal in its strategy and tactics and character. However, this is also going to be, if it happens, in fact it seems inevitable, is going to be the first partisan or guerrilla war in Europe in the social media era, by which I mean the potential then for communication between partisan groups, but also for then transmitting partisan information or propaganda to the outside world. Huge potential, obviously, and p- potentially then very damaging to the Kremlin. If you saw some of this in Afghanistan, didn't you, with the way in which the enemies of the allies operated, using social media and using the internet essentially to spread videos of RPG attacks, attacks on food convoys, all of that sort of stuff. So it could look and feel very different and very difficult for the Russians to handle. But then Putin's mindset would suggest that he's the kind of person who's going to respond to that with extreme brutality. And there is, of course, the example of the horrors of the way in which the Russians prosecuted the Chechen uprising and the Chechen war. So there's that risk. And then the other thing which I'm interested to hear more about is how does the West judge what's a sensible way to be involved? Because in the partisan warfare of the 1980s in Afghanistan, obviously the CIA and others were funding the rebels, the Mujahideen, and were flooding the place with weaponry and insights and expertise, and that of course then put the Russians on the back foot with spectacular historical consequences. Begins the unraveling of the Soviet economy and the Soviet Union ultimately in the end. But dealing with Putin in Europe rather than Afghanistan, what happens if the West then funds, and the UK government and the US have been reluctant to talk about how far they're prepared to go for this reason, I suspect, if they fund the partisans and essentially put in kit and weaponry, and it's coming through NATO countries, then you have a potential for flare-up. I'm not suggesting that they're doing that at the moment. They're aiding the sovereign government of Ukraine. But you're into different territory if that sovereign government disintegrates, or, as we wrote this week on Reaction, if it becomes a government in exile based in London, which seems to be the most likely outcome. So Maggie, I'm just trying to think through something which, of course, we're focused on the short-term horror of what's unfolding in Ukraine, and it seems like it's about to get a hell of a lot worse in the next few days and weeks. But beyond that is a long-term strategic challenge.
Well, even the short-term, I think, because you're both talking about the assumption that there will be a kickback and a partisan war. But what happens if Putin's troops do reach Kiev? I mean, they're 5 miles away in Obolon at the moment tonight, and they take the presidential palace. Zelensky is either whisked away by helicopter and comes to London, and they take basically control and put, you know, the rest of the troops on the streets. Do we really think that people will fight to the extent that perhaps a lot of people are hoping for? Or will they just, you know, accept that this is the next stage of their life?
Well,
I think we're making some very big assumptions there. And can I just want to, I know this is, I was in Kiev just for 3 days back in November 2019, and the overriding impression and mood I got, and others who I spoke to who were there for a conference, was one of fear. It was a really weird, I've only ever had that feeling actually in Moscow, but particularly amongst the young. I mean, it seems sort of on the surface all quite modern and contemporary and, you know, people getting on with what we might call a Western life, but actually most of the youngsters didn't want to talk. They would sort of tell you their name, but you know, when you're traveling and staying in hotels, you tend to talk to people about what they're doing. But there was a real reticence, and what you felt was one of fear that they didn't know whether you were a spy. That was the sort of feeling I came away with. So as we said, you know, they have been living with this for years and years, and I just wonder to what extent they will fight back.
Don't know. I think we're about to find out. We're about to find out as we're recording this. The TV news and social media is full of accounts of weapons being distributed, weaponry, anti-tank weapons, which can be utilized on street corners. I think 20,000, 18,000 or 20,000guns issued this morning in central Kiev. Well, as we're recording this, Maggie, of course, there are loads of reports on TV and on social media of weaponry being distributed to civilians, and there are partisan groups. The focus immediately, maybe it's just because the media seems to be there, but also you were saying, Alistair, it might eventually become a rural resistance. But I think in the first phase, anyway, it seems as though the focus is primarily urban, which, because that then makes it more difficult for the Russians, if they've got troops in the city, to then utilize air power without causing their own side collateral damage. So fighting an urban partisan resistance, at least in the first phase, is then potentially very, very messy in terms of casualties, flattening of buildings, all of this sort of horror, which it seems is about to come. We just don't know the answer to your question, Maggie, about whether people will fight. I mean, the statements from people, the Ukrainians who have returned, various sports people who've and celebrities who've flown back into the country since the invasion happened, and since the Putin began his barbarism the other morning, then suggests that there is something there. I think it's so. We're going to find out what that sort of partisan war looks like, and the West is going to have to decide how it helps and supports that without fueling further escalation or some sort of standoff with NATO. That we'll come back to NATO and rearmament and all that in a moment. Alistair, you wanted to jump in.
Well, the paradox about guerrilla warfare is that the less we know strategically, the better for them. Yeah. If they're going to do it. Yes. It has to remain hidden. They have to be, like, to recall Lawrence of Arabia, a vapor. Whereas, I mean, he uses the metaphor of armies being like plants and guerrilla warfare's more like a vapor blowing around. Quote, I think I've got it here, kingdoms lay in each man's mind, and we wanted nothing material to live on, so we offered nothing material to the killing. But yeah, I mean, we shall see. But I think there is something going on, just from, you know, these reports. But again, the costs of, you know, a proper partisan war, that is a major, major cost. And we have to think about that as well.
Yeah.
Can I throw a slightly counterintuitive idea into the mix, which is, I don't know about you, but I've been struck by the enthusiasm and the ferocity, if you like, of the protests in Russia, and the bravery of the people protesting on the streets, sort of 50 cities yesterday, and they're still protesting today. Plus, you have about 150 different security officials, supposedly, who've written to Putin objecting to the policy. A lot of the supposed businessmen, oligarchs, are also very nervous. And I just wonder whether, you know, maybe Putin has gone too far even for them, and that the real unrest might not come within Russia itself, which, of course, is what Putin always feared would actually come from a prosperous democratic Ukraine, but actually maybe he stirred up his own country. I don't know. Just throw
it's possible, and it's quite a bit has been written about this, and people have commented on social media, just highlighting the individual bravery of Russians of all generations turning out. Sometimes just lone protests. There was one reporter for a Russian trade unionist journalist, essentially began just a protest, just holding up a simple sign near Red Square, and knowing that the protesters are then followed from home and arrested on the spot, and arrested sometimes even as they're leaving home. But you're right, Maggie. There are thousands of people doing this, and on social media, and quite a few Russian celebrities and sports stars, surprisingly, in the last 24-48 hours, have essentially said no to war, and have expressed sympathy with the Ukrainians, which is
sort of unheard of in the past, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not entirely unheard of, but just there's clearly something going on there, which the West will hope flares up into something bigger. But he has such a grip of the Russian state and the security apparatus, and if you watch the bizarre, as I know we all did, the bizarre session on Monday. It's only, we're recording this on Friday, but it feels like a different world. That was Monday, was his security conference with all of the main players in the I was going to say the Soviet state, in the Russian state, reporting to him, and some of them being almost bullied by him, treated quite dismissively by a guy who did not look well. The other thing, who looked puffed up and stressed and very angry. And then there, of course, there were the bizarre speeches, bizarre speeches and messages threatening effectively nuclear retaliation, and presenting this analysis of greater Russia and the romantic myth of Russia always being put upon. And that's where I think, next thing to discuss, I think there are what happens from here beyond the short term of the terrible conflict unfolding in Ukraine is what is the West's response. And I think there are two areas to focus on. The first is rearmament, and what does that look like in practical terms without being hysterical about it. Europe having not taken its security collectively seriously enough, whether that's the British running down defence spending and thinking there was an extra peace dividend, the European Union failing to organise itself properly on this question, French attitudes to some kind of grand bargain with Russia, but also then spending most of its operational capability and energy on allying with the British, but then having a leader who's then spectacularly rude and dismissive of Britain. So the European defence space and security space is a mess. And it seemed to me, and I'll write more about this in the newsletter I'll put together for members of Reaction, which is out every Saturday morning. And I'll, in this week's edition, I want to look at this, just practically what you do, because it was a speech about as much about the Baltics and about smacking down the Poles. And this afternoon, the Russian Foreign Ministry has issued a warning to the Swedes and the Finns, who've seen this coming for a while and are increasingly worried about their defence and their situation, that if they even think about joining NATO, as the Finns are now starting to agitate to do, then there will be serious political and military consequences, whatever that means. So we need to start thinking practical military and security terms. What does increased spending look like? Where is it deployed? How can Poland and the Baltics be defended? How much is America prepared to do? Which is an open question ahead of the midterms, and with the possibility of President Trump being back, I don't think Europe can actually rely on the Americans being there throughout what's going to be, I think, quite a long and drawn out conflict or standoff, unless Putin himself is somehow removed internally in Russia. So we can't then necessarily rely on the Americans. So what is it that we as Europeans in and out of the EU, in and out of NATO, propose to do in the next phase? And then the other thing I wanted to mention, Maggie, was energy, which you wrote about from a domestic but a European perspective this week.
Absolutely. Well, the impact, where do you start on energy? One of the reasons why so many EU countries have been so reluctant to impose full-scale sanctions is because they depend so much on Russian gas being piped from Ukraine and from Germany. I mean, Italy has said sanctions, yes, but not handbags, luxury goods, and not gas. Belgium has said not diamonds. I mean, you can see every country's weak spots, can't you? And of course, the Germans have suspended Nord Stream. And what it shows is how utterly dependent, reliant the whole of Europe, including Britain, and we import coal, gas, and oil from Russia, not huge amounts, but enough, particularly through the winter when we need critical. And it just sort of is a mockery of how we've all failed to not necessarily be self-sufficient, but certainly have security of supplies. And this just exposes that dreadful catastrophe, really.
Yeah, there's a really, really good report which I will which I'll link to in the newsletter from the Baker Institute, which is a study of the Baker Institute at Rice University, which is a study by experts on energy studies and gas supply and geopolitics. And it's a 24-page run through the dilemma facing the broader West. But, well, America doesn't have an energy crisis, or not to the same extent, but the crisis facing the West, and particularly Europe, in terms of gas supplies. What happens if he restricts supply further? Storage capacity, or the amount of gas in storage in Europe, is run pretty low at the moment, and the report points towards next winter. It says it's not really just about the short-term emergency with the next 6 weeks coming, and who knows what on earth Putin is going to attempt next. The danger is that we think we've got away with it in the spring and then forget about next winter. Proposes a range of ways to fill the shortfall. The US is obviously the biggest LNG exporter in the world. Second is Qatar. There are talks between the Americans and the Qataris in terms of speeding up and diverting supplies to Europe. But it really is attempting to keep the lights on and keep European industry flowing. Because if we were recording this a week ago, we were still discussing whether Putin was going to do it or not. Mm. I mean, some people thought he would, some people thought he wouldn't. It was a question of whether he's bluffing. Well, a week later, he's done it. And the new reality is you have to operate, I think, calmly, non-hysterically, on the basis of preparing for the worst economically and in terms of rearmament and defending Europe's borders. But on the energy point, it just makes a series of, and I'll lay it out in the piece tomorrow, calculations about energy supply, nuclear, how renewable can't, certainly not at speed, fill the gap in anything like the way that's needed. And then, Maggie, we've had this...
Oil consumption, even with the growth of renewables, oil consumption has been growing. You know, it still supplies 30% of all the world's domestic and industrial needs. And that share is going up. You know, renewables just cannot make up for that. And, of course, they're not reliable. So I'm going to say Shell also warned this week. They're the biggest LNG supplier in the world. And they were warning that, you know, there are just not enough storage plants across Europe. And of course, we've wound ours down too. Brilliant. But we have to move very, very quickly to shore.
There's a lot of blame to go round. Mm. And I'm not saying people on my side of the argument have got every assumption right about this, but when you see Angela Merkel pop up having done what she did and what her governments did in terms of nuclear capacity, coal-fired capacity, and gleefully signing those deals, the picture of her grinning in, I think, 2008 or whenever the first Nord Stream pipeline went on, and placing then Germany and more widely Europe in this appalling strategic position and being lauded for years as the political genius, the master of Europe. Well, it was all really for naught, or not very much in the end, I would say. And there needs to be a new spirit of realism. And I don't see it yet. In the UK government, I think, has responded pretty well in defence terms and in rhetorical terms, and the position that it's mapped out in the last few months and warning that this was possible and that diplomacy with Putin was very difficult. That's fine. But the UK's not yet had an address from the Prime Minister, who seems terrified of his wife's views on the environment and various other conservative organisations who are very much on the COP26 net zero as soon as possible side of the argument. He seems to want to avoid that issue. At some point, if this is to be dealt with properly, him or whoever as Prime Minister needs to go on television and say, listen, there's been a cross-party failure here on energy security and supply. Climate matters, and all sorts of green technologies may actually even emerge, you know, on battery technology. All that sort of stuff can sometimes be sped up in a war era, but you still need the lights to stay on. You still need industrial capacity and homes to be heated this time next year. And that involves revisiting economic and energy policy because the facts have changed, and so he's changing his mind. But there's no indication that that happens yet. Alistair, just you've been slightly perturbed by some of the responses to what's happened in the last few days. Some of the hysteria.
People react in emotional ways in with traumatic events. It's not that. It's more. I agree. We need to. There needs to be a kind of new realism. I would say that the idea that, you know, I think Poland and the Baltic states and Sweden, Finland, all these places which are sort of in this zone down Europe's eastern flank, we need to be supportive of them, and they are part of the NATO alliance and part of the Article 5 collective defense. I'm not so worried, to be honest, about them, cause for sort of several reasons. Ukraine is the crucible for actually a long unwinding after 91 of various old geopolitical certainties giving way to new ones, new and potentially quite destabilizing ones. It has been a between, for example, Europe's aspiration to a collective defense and Russia's sense, however paranoid, of it, the security of its border and its collective security, plus the forces of democratization, plus geopolitical kind of might, which emerged in the 90s all around the world, supported by, you know, what people call the Euro-Atlantic Alliance. Ukraine has been at the sort of center of those things clashing. And that is what makes Ukraine actually a genuine historical tragedy. And I think there is an element here where we are, and I'm echoing Paul Zanieri's fantastic book on titled Ukraine and Russia, From Civilized Divorce to Uncivil War. I was just reading the first chapter this morning, brilliant book. And he puts it so well. He just says that there is a sense when we talk about, and this is a book written after 2014 Crimea, says that people slightly overestimate the degree to which politicians in the West and in Russia and in Ukraine could have acted differently, given the long kind of the long view that actually is sort of coming to fruition in Ukraine. And I think that's something we need to bear in mind. Not all, when people, for example, say, well, what about Taiwan? Is it next? We have to roll back slightly and say, well, no, it's a different scenario. It's not the same. In the Baltic states and Poland, I think it is extremely unlikely, you know, that Russia will try and annex. It's not least because these countries, I mean, Finland has a tiny Russian-speaking minority, for example. Already in Ukraine, Putin has taken extraordinary gamble, which may or may not pay off. And we've talked about it with the guerrilla warfare and the potential in Russia for, you know, not just for the population to revolt, but the people around Putin, the sort of 1,000 people who make up the Kremlin security apparatus, who may or may not be particularly satisfied with him. I think that we need to prepare for the worst, but I also think we need to be a bit clear-eyed about the context in Ukraine.
Yeah, does that make sense? I think, it does make sense. I mean, where I slightly disagree is that I think now that he has actually started behaving in a proper, I know I said that he was a Russian imperialist, so it's going way back before Stalin style behavior, but when he starts to behave like, as he has this week, like a proper 1930s 1940s 1950s tyrant with very strange things going on in his head, and who knows where the sort of fantasy begins and ends and reality and cold calculation kicks in. Don't know. And Western intelligence is presumably trying to find that out and debating it like mad, because it contains the clues of how they respond and how seriously they should take it. But I just think you have to history suggests that you should begin by then assuming the worst about where it might lead. Where I think the Baltics, I know exactly what you mean about the Ukraine being for a certain kind of Russian or Russian nationalist like or imperialist like Putin, it's part of this mythology of greater Russia, and I get all of that, and I get the historical connections. But the Baltics are similarly, I mean, they're more annoying to him, you know, more of an irritation rather than sort of, but it is also a deep historic wound because of what happened, well, in the 1940s, and then the disintegration of the Soviet Union. And they are another example, even more blatant in a funny way than the Ukraine, of rivals to the Russian Putin model in terms of economic success. You know, the European Union being a factor, trade, technology, freedom, small countries showing that it's perfectly possible to dramatically increase GDP and be engaged with the outside world and be free and have travel and a modern population. So they are in their way a direct counter to Putinism. So that's the first reason that the Baltics matter so much. Secondly, it's about that area, and this is where sort of Finland matters and Sweden matters. It is, you're back then to Soviet notions of control of the Baltic itself, but controlling that sea and then the area beyond it being the North Atlantic, obviously, and Soviet, well, it wasn't dominance, but the Soviets being in the Cold War era major players in the North Atlantic, butting up against NATO and the Americans and the Brits. So I think it has potential. Tim Marshall is our columnist who writes brilliantly about maps. I think the Baltics, Finland and Sweden may matter more than we think in the next phase of this. And particularly if his sense of rage increases and he feels that he needs to, and I would rather not take the risk. I would rather say via NATO, which is I think what NATO will do. Right, defense spending is going to have to go up across Europe. Who's in for this and who's not? And realistically, what does that plan look like for the next 6 months to a year to dramatically increase the defenses of the states that I describe? I suspect that that's what will happen. Do you think I'm overreacting, Maggie?
No, and it's interesting because Finland has actually just bought a whole new fleet of air forces, the F-35 from Lockheed, if I am correct in memory. And they're not even in NATO, so they've clearly been arming themselves. And there's even talk that maybe Germany will have to build up a proper army. It does raise the question, of course, of Macron's idea of a European army, although they can't even get sanctions together. So I doubt, you know, I doubt validity of that, of his ambition there. And I'm sure Britain and France will probably increase. I'm sort of midway between you and Alistair on this. I do think you said earlier on, you used the word Putin's mythology of the Ukraine, but it was more than a mythology, wasn't it? It was part of Mother Russia for, what, 300-400 years. And if you read his essay, the essay he wrote last year, a 6,000-worder, you know, a lot of Russians do believe it is a genuine part of it, part of the Russian Empire. So I think that is emotionally, again, as Alistair put it, the crucible. The other states, I don't know. I mean, do we think that we would, if Finland, Sweden were to apply for NATO tomorrow, would we give it automatically?
I would hope so. I would hope so. I think it'd be calamitous if they attempted and were publicly rebuffed. I mean, I've seen some suggestions that people have to think very carefully about it because it'd be seen as an escalation. But
exactly.
I'm afraid we're in quite basic geopolitical territory. If the Finns and the Swedes, sophisticated modern economies, parts of the free world, feel so menaced and have put up with a lot in recent years in terms of, you know, Russia sort of scoping the place and you know, running agents and running operations and all that sort of stuff. If they, as our allies, say, listen, this is now really serious and we are changing decades of history and historic positioning in terms of effectively, well, neutrality, and you could describe it as neutrality. If they come to the West and say, we need help and we want to join, it would be a calamity to say no. It's the basic question, what business is it of the Russians? If the Finns and the Swedes decide that they want to be even closer friends with NATO and that their interests lie in being properly, fully integrated and allied with Western defence mechanisms, then, I mean, no wonder. You just need to turn on the television and see what's happening in Ukraine. And there's nothing to guarantee that something similar wouldn't happen in, God forbid it, you know, next year in the archipelago, or if he gets away with this, or he seeks some other sort of, you know, fake provocation. So I think it's safer to operate on the basis that we should all, we stick together or we hang separately.
But Ian, I just would, again, that they are not, they're not quite the same. The Ukraine, you know, is a, you know, those countries, Finland and Sweden, have strong state capacity. They are not, Ukraine has, for the last, one of the tragedies of modern Ukraine is that it has remained in many ways a very weak state.
Yeah.
While Russia has become a strong state and its closest neighbor. Finland, Sweden, the Baltic states are not weak states. They are, you know, have control over their own territories. They do not have the kinds of problems Ukraine has had with its minorities. And I think we do have to just roll back and think, well, in Ukraine, there is a history going back from 91 and in the last decades and in the decade before that. I mean, you know, where, you know, one of the reasons, for example, why Ukraine, you know, is not in, did not join NATO at the same time as the Baltic states, is because in Ukrainian politics was very much divided between people who were pro, you know, represented interests probably closer to the Kremlin, and people who were more westernizing, and that tension has been there in Ukrainian politics for, you know, throughout the, we know through the noughties and 2010 and with the Maidan, you know. So I think there are various reasons why what has gone on in Ukraine, there isn't necessarily a kind of domino effects, if you see what
I mean. But we're dealing, okay, but there is a very good
argument for strengthening and being realistic, of course, and getting rid of our dependency on Russian you know, hydrocarbons and all that. I totally agree with all that, but I'm just saying, you know, I think there is just a, I think that's unlikely, and I may be wrong about that, but just seems to be unlikely.
I mean, I think that, and what you said about the having control of their territory, etc., that is not that's not really borne out by just how worried they are now. Both well, the Swedes have run down their defense capability, and both the Swedes and the Finns are urgently, as Maggie pointed out, looking for ways to strengthen it, escalate it, increase defense spending. I mean, the Swedes are in the ridiculous position of, it's less than a decade since the prime minister, in a fit of, we live in a world of peace, who needs defences, concreted up the defensive positions, pillboxes, communication posts, etc., in the archipelago, which is then impossible to fix and to restore, because peace was going to last forever, and is now going to have to be rebuilt, or new defences are going to have to be rebuilt at much greater cost than all the concrete costs. So that's the sort of debate that's happening in Sweden, and then Finland is spending, as Maggie said, on kit. So I think they're right to be worried, and I think he's demonstrated this week that he'll attempt just about anything, and we should operate on the basis that he's capable of. If he's capable of this, he's capable of worse.
I agree, but they don't have, for example, what Ukraine has, which is, I mean, the state for over a decade now has faced extreme challenges in terms of that was what was so humiliating in 2014. They were effectively beaten back, the Ukrainian army, by militia separatists. And that's why they actually, in the intervening period, that's what we're talking about with the partisan stuff and their military, they've been more serious about it. But that situation is particular. And that's all I'm saying.
Understood. I think, shall we just quickly, just before we wrap up, shall we talk about the British response? What have you made of it, Maggie?
Well, I know that Boris Johnson has been subject to quite a lot of criticism, both left and right, if you like, right across the spectrum, for not going far enough. But I would not be so I wouldn't rush to criticize him, because I think in the first tranche, they really hit, you only need to hit five banks and VTB and Sherbank are the main banks, so that they handle most of the big oligarchs and companies' assets. So in that sense, it was on target. And the same with those first individuals. But as of yesterday, another 100 were added to the list. And I just read right through. And as of Tuesday, there'll be a new law which stops any Russian companies raising money on the stock exchange, which is obviously a huge source of raising new capital for them, and a raft of other measures, which look quite far-reaching, and also hitting out at, of course, the entities, the bankers and the lawyers here in London who work for them, because that's very important too. You've got to cut off their source of legitimacy, if you like. So I think that they've been pretty hard. I would say that calls to have all citizens, Russian citizens, banned from the UK and their children taken out of schools is just fantastical, really, and really silly, because there are an awful lot of Russians who live here because they want to escape Putin's regime. And we should accept that. Where I think maybe... another point. Are sanctions effective? I think you almost need to, that's our starting point. Putin has been building up for this for years. He's got 650 billion of foreign reserves sitting there. So he's clearly, he's got a long-term plan.
Yeah, he's stockpiled gold. He's running debt to GDP. He's got right down to little more than
20%. So he's been planning this, and whilst we say it will really hurt him to cut off all the money for gas, that's not true. China buys an awful huge amount from him, and so do the Indians. So he can withstand this. He can stockpile the gas and watch the price soar even higher. And also, I think there's a social and a cultural issue that we have to look at, which is, I think, a lot of Russians, not all, of course, it'd be dreadful to stereotype, but actually the more the West sort of hits them, the more they'll be stoic. We saw that, in all the wars. So they will withstand it.
True.
And I think that's very important. Sorry, Alistair.
Yeah, sorry, Maggie. I totally agree that the record of sanctions worldwide, I mean, there's kind of a long history of sanctions. In the early 20th century, they were sort of seen like blockades as these incredible devices where you could just win wars without doing anything material. And it's like the record of sanctions, economic sanctions, is really mixed in terms of its actual aims. I mean, there are plenty of countries which had heavy sanctions for decades, and it's either made the internal dynamics of repression dissent worse, or it hasn't really improved much. So I think we need to
And you have to look at Iran to see the impact, or the lack of an impact.
Isn't it ultimately, though, Alistair, it's a diversion or a diversionary tactic, which is understandable. And democracies, I can remember the birth of the idea of sanctioning. Maybe some historian will tell me that I'm wrong, but I seem to remember it really developing as a popular idea and media and political class idea after the first Gulf War, or sort of late 80s, 90s. And in some senses, it's laudable, isn't it? Because we don't want war. I mean, who actually who seeks it or relishes or enjoys it, it comes with horrendous consequences. But I was reading Chris Coker's book, Why War, I think it's called, his most recent book. Chris Coker's great academic at the LSE, expert on international relations, warfare, strategy, one of the very best brains around. And of course, at the heart of that is this idea that, well, war is the human thing and part of the human state. You seek to avoid it where you can and construct legal mechanisms to avoid it. And that's probably what international law is for, and diplomacy and statecraft and all the rest of it. But ultimately, there isn't a perfect peace that mankind is going to build. Warfare will continue to happen as long as mankind is around and functioning. And you can see why in the last 30, 40 years, after the horrors of the 20th century, we build this idea of war prevention being the most important thing that states do. And here is a set of devices that sound really tough: sanctions, and ministers of various democratic states can go on television and announce them and say, we're hitting them hard and we're hitting them where it hurts. I'm not saying we shouldn't do that, but it is a bit of a diversion away from the human core mission, which is if there are tyrants out there or people who actually enjoy the glory of war and really want conflict for its own sake, and Putin seems to be in that historical category, then your primary duty is to, if you want to avoid conflict, is to protect yourself and to arm yourself and defend yourself in the way that the West did in the Cold War. That's ultimately, that worked, and the West won, thank goodness. And it seems to me as though the chatter, which got more and more excited this week in London, with people shouting about sanctions, this sanction's not tough enough, that sanction's not tough enough, why is Boris doing this, is because he's too friendly with Russians, and who knows, we'll find out when people's memoirs are published. But it strikes me as a bit of a diversion. Does that make sense, Alistair? A bit of a diversion from real geopolitics and war planning.
Yeah, well, I just think, again, that's coming back to my first point, we just need to think very clearly about what will work and what fits with a realistic strategy in what is obviously now a multipolar dispensation, where China and Russia, Iran and North Korea to an extent, are and countries like Turkey in its own way, are not that they're all the same at all, but it's just that they are forging. We've got to take it seriously that we are confronted with systems where people genuinely believe that their form of life is worth pursuing and actually incurring huge costs, which are including economic. And that's just something we have to adjust to. And it's just, and that's the realism, you know, that, but I mean, also stuff like, I mean, it is the last thing, on the kind of, on the register of things to care about, but calls in London to, for example, potentially expel Russian citizens, to have that on the table, as it were. Tom Tugendhat was saying that, chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. That is just there are many Russians. Russia is not Putin, just as Russia was not the Soviet Union or the Communist Party of Lenin and Stalin. And
I think there are many
Russians in the UK who I know are appalled and anti-Putin or just neutral and non-political. And I just,
it's low on the calculus.
I think it's things we should be worrying about. But I just think that is supremely unhelpful, really.
Yeah, but I think we have to be careful of misreporting and reporting slightly out of context. Maybe he could have framed it slightly differently, but as I read it and read the full quote, Tom Tugendhat was not saying expel all Russians. He was saying that power exists for all Russians. Do you see what I mean? There's a subtle difference which then got kind of lost in the
headline. Should be on the table. That's what
I mean. But I don't think he was advocating evicting every one of Russian heritage from the UK. He was saying anyone with Russian passport, that the measures exist if certain criteria are met. So I don't think he was envisaging a complete ban. What was the other thing that you mentioned, you highlighted on social media, Alistair, was the business of the Russian ballet, because that's already starting to spread, isn't it? Cultural and sporting boycotts. And it's difficult to work out where the right line is. People, obviously the Finns want the Russians kicked out of the Eurovision song contest. Well, that's already happened, has it?
Yeah, it's happened. Yeah. And then there's the football, aren't they?
Yeah.
FIFA's pulled.
But then why, as you asked, Alistair, then why should a young Moscow ballet company be effectively boycotted, which is what appears to have happened in Dublin, is that right?
Yeah, yes, it's a performance of Swan Lake by the Royal Moscow Ballet at the theatre, the Helix in Dublin, has been, here's the statement. As a result of the events in Ukraine, crucial that all civilized countries take all practical steps to stand in solidarity with the people of Ukraine. Mm. And, cultural boycotts, as we've seen, for example, with Israel, really achieve their aims and, in fact, the big criticism, for example, of the BDS movement with Israel is that it actually has solidified a kind of bunker mentality in the Israeli sort of, elites. And that's actually been counterproductive. So I think, just recalling when Rostropovich, the great Russian cellist, who was a great believer in the possibilities of his country and a democrat, was playing Dvorak during the Prague Spring when Russian Soviet tanks were rolling into Prague. And he was heckled in London, actually, during that performance. But, this guy who was opposed the authorities in Russia, but was simply a cellist and was a huge admirer of Czech culture and Dvorak. And I just think, that is a very powerful statement, actually, saying that these solidarities exist across borders and actually that Russians don't, many Russians don't want this. And I think not allowing mostly ordinary Russians to make those statements if they want to is counterproductive.
I think
in fact, we should be encouraging them and we should be supporting all those, the ballet dancers, the musicians, because I guess most of them would not be supportive of the regime. Perhaps that's a bit too, but they are more likely to want a Western style of life and then to be the ones who protest against Putin. So we should be backing them to the hilt.
I think that's a good note on which to end this week's episode of the Reaction Podcast. We meant to talk for about half an hour. We've ended up talking, I think, for about an hour, and hopefully it's been enjoyable and useful for our listeners. I'm Ian Martin, editor of Reaction. I was joined by Alistair Benn and Maggie Pogano from the Reaction team. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction and you haven't seen the site, or you want my weekly newsletter and you get Maggie's column on business, you get all sorts of great writing, including Tim Marshall writing every Friday on geopolitics, Bruce Anderson on politics, host of other brilliant columnists like Gerald Warner and David Waywell and Alice Crossley, other members of the team. There's a host of writing every day, a daily evening briefing on the story that we think matters, untangling and explaining the news, and lots more. So the link is below. Become a member of Reaction. And until next time on the Reaction Podcast, thank you very much for listening.